This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. This is Why It's So Like That, a show that explores the mind, our behavior, and why we are the way we are. On today's show, we'll be exploring the science of heroism and altruism. Are heroes born or made? Why do humans behave altruistically even if it sometimes comes at a heavy cost to themselves? Elizabeth Svoboda explores those questions in her book, What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, let's start with your definition of altruism.
Well, in the simplest possible terms, it's just doing something kind for somebody else without expecting anything necessarily in return. And to me, the extreme of that would be heroism, which in the more classical definition actually involves putting yourself at risk or putting yourself on the line in some way in order to help somebody else. So there are different degrees of it. I sort of see it as a continuum moving from altruism on the more everyday end of things to heroism, which involves these more big time risks that you might be taking.
As you were writing this book, I'm sure you've spoken to people who, I guess, were more of the everyday heroes kind of category. Could you tell me if there were any stories that stood out to you?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, one of my favorite everyday heroes is just somebody who I met maybe 10 years ago. I had just moved to my current hometown, San Jose, California, and I was looking for a way to be more involved in the community. And I met this guy named Jeff Bornefeld, who ran an organization that paired teens who were in some way at risk. You know, maybe they had bad grades, maybe they had struggled with drugs, things like that. And he took those kids and he paired them with adults from the community to set up mentoring relationships. And, you know, for decades, he did this work in the community. You know, he never asked for anything in return. And, you know, he wasn't the guy who was always in the front page of the newspaper. He didn't fish anyone out of an icy lake or, you know, save anyone out of a burning house. But to me, what he did, even though it was more in this everyday altruism category, over 10 or 20 years, that leads up to what I consider a heroic life, just because day in, day out, he devoted himself to the well-being of these kids. So, yeah, he is definitely foremost in my mind as an everyday hero who I admire.
Does he consider himself to be a hero?
I would say not. And this is something that I saw consistently among people who the rest of us say, oh, wow, that person is definitely heroic. Most of the time, they'll just say, oh, no, I'm not a hero. I'm just doing what I thought was the right thing to do in this situation. And, you know, I think it's very genuine. I think they often are very humble people. And I think they expect a lot of themselves, so that putting themselves out there, devoting a lot of time to their causes, that just seems very normal to them. Whereas maybe for some other people, that would be too much to ask. They wouldn't want to put themselves out there that way.
So what compels someone to be a hero or an altruist? Is it something you're born with or something you can build?
I think there's a little bit of both. I think the science on the brain and altruism is still in its pretty early days. But so far, what we seem to see is that, yes, there are some differences in people's brains in specifically the degree of reward they get when they do something kind or they do something selfless. Just basically, some people like giving money to charity or helping people more than others. It gives them that sort of this boost of pleasure. And so I would say probably people who enjoy that experience of giving are going to be more likely to repeat that behavior more often than somebody who doesn't enjoy the experience is dreading that. So there may be a genetic basis to that. We just don't know what the exact gene is, but we do see sometimes these physical differences in the brain. But what I like to emphasize, it's definitely not predetermined whether or not you're going to live a selfless life or even a heroic life. There are a lot of things that you can do to steer that course for yourself, to define for yourself what you think a heroic life is, and then to carry out that vision. So that's the bottom line for me, is that it's really in your hands whether you choose to be an altruist throughout your life. It's not genetically determined, even though there may be some genes that affect whether you enjoy it as much as others.
Are there evolutionary reasons behind why humans are altruistic? For one, putting yourself at risk seems to go against the theory of survival of the fittest. Because if humans had been putting themselves in great danger to help others, wouldn't the genes of those people who are predisposed to heroism and altruism not be passed on?
Right. Well, I think, you know, certainly there is a little bit of that survival of the fittest. But, you know, what people sometimes overlook is that there are other forces going on as well within biology. A more recent theory that's been discussed is not without controversy, but the theory is that in a group where people or animals are good at cooperating with one another, that group is going to do better from one generation to the next than another group where there might be a lot of internal fighting, even people killing each other, things like that. So that there are benefits, even from a reproductive standpoint, to being in a group that is overall harmonious, peaceful, where you have members that support each other and help each other. So you can see how if you're comparing a generous group to a group where people are more selfish and jockeying for position, that the generous group, more of its members are going to thrive, the group is going to grow. And then on an individual level, it makes sense that if you are part of that strong cooperative group, you might actually be improving your own reproductive chances just because you're living in better conditions, you're more likely to get help from people. So it just fosters this environment that is pretty much a good thing for everyone involved. So there is the survival of the fittest perspective, and I think we certainly see biologically that there is competition between individuals, but sometimes these larger scale group forces are at play as well, and that could help explain a lot of the altruistic behavior that we see in humans.
After this, I'll talk to Elizabeth about why good people fail to act in bad situations. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. The subject of today is the science of heroism and altruism, and my guest is Elizabeth Svoboda, author of What Makes a Hero: The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, how does the brain respond to acts of altruism?
Well, there have been some very interesting experiments looking at that. There's one chapter of my book where I had some discussions with a biologist at the University of Oregon whose name was Bill Harbaugh. I apologize, he's an economist. But basically what he was doing is he took people and put them in a functional MRI scanner, and he asked the question, what is happening inside these people's brains as they decide on a computer screen whether they're going to give money to different charities and how much? And the interesting thing was, in this experiment, participants knew that they were working with real money. Whatever balance they had in their online account, when they finished all the giving questions in the experiment, that they would actually be able to take that home as cash. So there was real skin in the game here. And the interesting thing that he found was that when people gave, when they made that decision to contribute to a charity that they considered a worthy cause, there was an area of the brain activated called the nucleus accumbens. And the nucleus accumbens is an area that's associated with rewards. So in other words, when you are giving, you might get sort of the same rush that you get even from a glass of wine or meeting with an old friend who you haven't seen in a long time, that it really does feel that good on a biological level to give. And just out of curiosity, I participated in this experiment myself, and I was very curious to see whether I was in fact a person who got pleasure from giving that would show up on a brain scan. And when Dr. Harbaugh looked at my brain scans, he said, well, yeah, you do seem to be somebody whose brain experiences reward when you give. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. That's great to know, because, you know, this is something I know I'm going to get pleasure out of it. So I should just keep doing it and really establish it as a habit in my life.
Okay, so the brain rewards generous and altruistic behavior, but there are times, despite the reward, we fail at being altruistic or generous. Someone may donate blood often enough, but they wouldn't stop to give money to someone who's homeless on the street, for example. Why does this, I guess, contradictory behavior happen?
Right. That's a good point. And I think one of the factors that's at play is sometimes we tune things out because our brains get overwhelmed. In the example that you gave of the homeless person on the street, if you live, for instance, in San Francisco here in California, or another city where you do see homeless people all the time, you might just start to tune them out because you're saying to yourself, there are so many of these people and I'm starting to feel helpless because I know that I can't help them all. And so I just don't give to any of them. And, you know, in the same way, if you read a report in the paper about thousands of children who are starving in a faraway country that you don't know much about, you're probably going to tune out as well. It just sort of the sense of overwhelm, like you conclude that this is a problem that's too big for me to do anything about. And there was even an experiment showing that the larger the number of people you think are in need of aid, the more that most people tend to detach from feeling like they're obligated to help. That's something they call compassion collapse. And so that's kind of depressing. Like, we do know that our brains kind of, you know, enter this overwhelmed state when we know that there are a lot of people in need of help, when it seems like, wouldn't it be better if our brains would be even more motivated to help the more people need help? So that part of it is sort of unfortunate. But there are ways that I think we can use our brain's tendency to care more about people on a one-on-one basis. We can actually use that trait to inspire altruistic behavior. So one way to bring out your altruistic side, for instance, you know, instead of trying to think about saving an entire population of thousands of refugees at once, which is basically out of reach for your average person to do, you know, you might get to know a single refugee or a small group of refugees who maybe who have moved to your city from somewhere where they've been in trouble. And when you get to know somebody on that individual level, you know, you might get to see exactly what their lives are like, what they need, how they're sort of dealing with their reality day to day. And oftentimes, if you're like many of us, once you start to form that kind of relationship with somebody, that sort of awakens your compassion. And it also awakens your commitment to do something about the problems that you see. And sometimes charities use this as well. If you donate to an organization that helps children overseas, you might be asked to sponsor an individual child rather than helping 1,000 kids at once.
So this is in a context where we might have more time to think. But what about in a situation where it's an emergency and it happens in a public place, and you know, sometimes we also fail to act in that situation? What's happening there?
Right. I think that's a little bit different phenomenon. And I think part of what determines whether we act or we don't act in these more high-stakes situations is whether we feel capable. And oftentimes that boils down to, do we have the right kind of training or the right kind of preparation to make a difference here? For instance, if a bomb blast goes off and there's pandemonium, there's chaos, you know, there's people who are bleeding, oftentimes what you will see is that the people who have medical training will be the ones who are recognized as the heroes because they're the first ones to rush in. They have that training to be able to make a difference for these people, whether it's to tie a tourniquet, stabilize a limb that seems to be broken. You know, sometimes it's not about whether you're a quote unquote good person or bad person. It's more about whether you're prepared. And so if you're somebody who envisions yourself wanting to intervene in these kind of split second scenarios where you have to decide right away what to do, I think it's great to consider signing up for life-saving training or for some kind of preparation where you might feel as confident as possible that you're going to be able to make a difference here.
We'll be back real quick after these messages. In just a bit, I'll be asking Elizabeth for some advice on how we can learn to be more selfless. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It's the Evening Edition, and I'm Kelvin Yee. This is Why You're So Like That, a show that's about the mind, our behavior, and why we are the way we are. I'm having a conversation with Elizabeth Svoboda on the science of heroism and altruism. Why are humans selfless despite the heavy cost to their own lives? She explores that in her book, What Makes a Hero? The Surprising Science of Selflessness. Elizabeth, the definition of who is a hero and what constitutes a heroic act is one that is constantly shifting. It's no longer just about saving cats from trees or rescuing people from a burning house. A recent act of heroism is probably whistleblowing. In the US, Edward Snowden exposed the fact that American intelligence was actually conducting extensive surveillance. It's come at a great cost to himself. He's not been able to return home since then. Would you agree that whistleblowing is a form of heroism?
Right, exactly. I do see it as a very important kind of altruism. Basically, as you say, what's happening is that whistleblowers are putting their comfort or even their well-being or their lives at risk in defense of a larger cause, like fairness or justice. So certainly it's a contribution to society, basically at your own expense. And it takes a very special type of person to make that sacrifice.
Could you help us understand why some of us would make that call and why some of us wouldn't? Because, you know, Edward Snowden wasn't the only person working in that program. There were so many, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people in that program as well.
Right. And, you know, in many of these situations, just as with Snowden, whistleblowers tend to be in the minority because of the huge hit that they tend to take. As you say, with Snowden, he hasn't been able to return to his home country. And I actually wrote a piece about whistleblowers for the Washington Post last year. And I talked to a lawyer for somebody who had been a whistleblower reporting bad practices at the company SpaceX, where he worked. And the lawyer told me that as a result of speaking out about what was going on, this man had lost his job and even eventually his home, and he ended up having to move in with friends. So basically his entire life was upended. So I think a lot of people are cognizant of the toll that being a whistleblower can take. And so you really, really have to value fairness and justice to a quite extraordinary degree. And often the people who are brave enough to be whistleblowers, they'll say, well, I knew what was at stake, but I wouldn't have been comfortable doing things any other way because, you know, that conscience is so strong telling me that I have to do something, even if it might be at cost to myself. So I think a lot of it has to do with the priority that we give to different values in our lives. If we value justice and fairness, for instance, over maybe being loyal to our boss, then we might be more likely to blow the whistle than somebody who values loyalty above fairness and transparency. So I think a good thing for people to do is sort of to give some thought to how you prioritize these types of values in your own life. So that if you're ever caught in a situation where you might have the opportunity to expose wrongdoing or corruption, that you'll know how you want to behave ahead of time instead of having to stress over that decision in a really tense moment.
Right. And how else can we encourage altruism? Can we build environments that encourage altruistic behavior?
Yes, certainly. And it starts at a very young age, as you might imagine. we know from studies that if you have role models who sort of exemplify this ideal of being altruistic, being selfless, that oftentimes you're going to behave that way yourself once you mature as an adult. And there was one study in particular that shows how this was at work in the lives of Holocaust rescuers, people who hid Jews from the Nazis. And afterward, a lot of them told interviewers that they had had a parent or some kind of close family member or close family friend who gave them this living example of how to be kind, sometimes how to put yourself on the line in order to help others. And so I think the importance of that kind of example, especially in early life, can't be overstated. But that said, if you didn't have somebody like that in your family growing up, and a lot of us don't, there are ways actually, I think, to create your own chosen family of role models that can encourage you in selflessness. In my book, I got to interview a group of people called real life superheroes in New York City. And yes, they were wearing superhero costumes. They sort of made a bit of a show out of it. But the bottom line was that they supported each other in doing these kind and generous acts, whether it was feeding animals at the animal shelter or giving out clothes to people in the winter who were really in need of clothes. And that having that social support from other people who were doing good sort of encouraged everybody in the group to stick with it. And it reminds me of, like, you know how you're more likely to go running if you're meeting somebody else at the gym so you can run together. I think the same goes for generosity, that you're more likely to stand behind these generous ideals when you have other people both supporting you and serving as role models for you.
And you also wrote in an article that the organizations that people are part of, be it the company that employs them or a place where they volunteer, can influence how someone acts in times of need. Could you talk about that for a bit? Because we are, you know, spending so much more time at work now than we did in the past.
Yes, I think organizational cultures, whether it's at a company or any other type of gathering, can make a huge difference. If you know that there's a culture, for instance, where whistleblowers are actually celebrated for taking a moral stand instead of losing status or even being punished, you are going to be way more likely to come forward if you see something that requires a whistleblower than maybe at another company where the whistleblowers are more likely to be punished. As humans, we are just very, very aware of how people who take different stands are treated within an organization. And that definitely informs our own behavior. And what we often see is companies nowadays are hiring consultants to come in and basically train people in how to take a stand. And part of the goal of doing that, of bringing these consultants in, I think, is to create more of a culture of the company where people feel empowered to take a stand. Like, if you know your company cares enough to hire somebody who makes sure everybody at the company knows what to do if they see some corruption, if they see some dishonesty, that makes an impact. That certainly, I think, gives you the power, if you're on this line of decision, whether to say something or not to say something, that might tip the balance toward you saying something.
One of the things you've pointed out also was the fact that people who have undergone significant suffering may emerge from the experience with higher levels of empathy. So if they go through a hard time, they tend to be more generous and more altruistic. Why does this happen?
Well, I think a lot is to do with just empathy. If you've gone through a difficult event yourself, whether it's abuse or surviving a natural disaster, you are going to look at people who are in that same situation, and you are going to understand very directly how they feel when they're in circumstances like that. And that empathy and that compassion that you feel for them is going to inspire you to help. And in studies, we see this where people who had survived a natural disaster or some kind of trauma themselves were more likely to say that they wanted to help collect money for victims who had experienced a similar disaster in their own lives. And what the researchers call this is altruism born of suffering. But I think we can often see examples of this in our own lives. For instance, if you're somebody who struggled with anxiety or depression, you might find yourself naturally willing to talk, to be sympathetic to somebody who finds themselves in a similar situation and is really struggling. So I think if we face our suffering in the right way and sort of ask ourselves the question, you know, what did I learn through this and how can I use that to give back to others who might be struggling? That's a great way to confront it. And in my book, I also talk about a woman named Jody Blanco who experienced terrible bullying when she was growing up. And that experience later in life inspired her to start an anti-bullying program called It's Not Just Joking Around, where she actually gives talks to elementary school students or high school students about the impact that bullying really has on the people who are the victims and, you know, to try to convince them that it's not worth it. So yeah, I think we can draw on these difficult things to help others. If we don't let our hearts become closed off through the pain that we've experienced, we can actually allow the pain to open our hearts.
So how can we be more altruistic then? Is it like a muscle that we can train to be stronger and to, you know, work better and more efficiently, I guess?
Absolutely. I love that analogy of a muscle, because one of the ways that I think we can develop that ability to be more altruistic is just to practice small everyday acts of kindness on a daily basis. And in my book, I talk a lot about Dr. Phil Zimbardo, the psychologist who founded the Heroic Imagination Project in San Francisco. And this is sort of one of his philosophies, that when we look for small things we can do for people, which could be, you know, something as simple as helping someone at the grocery store get their bags out to their car if they're struggling with, you know, a big load, just, you know, everyday things like that, that people don't even necessarily have to thank you for. But that when you train yourself to look for what other people need and help them with that, that you're also going to be good at anticipating what people need if you find yourself in a situation that's a bit more high stakes or calls for a larger selfless act. And so, yeah, that daily practice of just looking for what others need and seeing how you can fulfill that need, it is a great sort of altruistic muscle training, you could put it.
And I guess I just have maybe one final question, which is, you know, if it becomes as automatic as that, because whether it's a good act or whether it's an act that, you know, has hurt someone, the intent seems to come into question. With altruistic acts, do you think the intent ever matters? Because you spoke to people who just do it because, you know, they feel like it's the right thing to do and they don't really have any more noble, other noble intentions other than that, you know. Or some people, sometimes they do it, but with the hope that in the future, maybe that I'll be rewarded in the future for this. You know, when you do altruistic acts or when you do heroic acts, do you think the intent of the act matters?
I think it matters somewhat, but I think the most important thing is whether or not the good act gets done. So let's say you have somebody who's thinking about donating to a charity to help kids get mentors within the community. Well, maybe they're doing it because the organization says, oh, we're going to mention you in our annual brochure. You're going to be celebrated at our end of year party. Okay, so you could say that person is giving maybe for somewhat selfish reasons, but the end result of that person's decision to give is that the organization gets the money that they need to help kids. So I guess I'm sort of a pragmatist on this question. I don't care as much about people's motivations as long as others are getting helped.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for your time. That was Elizabeth Svoboda, author of What Makes a Hero, The Surprising Science of Selflessness. If you know someone whose goal is to be kinder this year, they might just be interested in this show. They can download the podcast from our BFM app. It's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.